So I'm here this afternoon with Chepo Skwambani, and we're going to kick off this interview. Chepo is consultant on the Making African Connections project, with particular expertise on the Botswana collection, which is what we're going to be talking about today. The Botswana collection at Brighton Museum, and also the partnership with Kama III Memorial Museum. So, Chepo, maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to have an interest in museums.
I was born in South Africa, lived for 7 years in Johannesburg, but some of my time was also spent in the rural areas where my mother came from, amongst the Bedi people. Living in an urban area, but also having a good dose of rural African life made me very curious about how we came to be, who we are as South Africans. As I grew up, I learned that my grandparents had had to move from the Shangaan area of South Africa, which is in the north, to gold mines in order to be able to meet, costs like the hut tax, which were introduced by the British colonial powers. I didn't know the reason at that point, but as I grew up, I started to understand that a lot of African people were wrenched from their homelands and forced into working as migrant laborers in Johannesburg, especially, and Kimberley. When my parents, who had to go into exile, they came to Britain and my father studied. When they came back, I started to understand the pressure that Black people were being put under. We moved to Swaziland on my 7th birthday. My father taught at Waterford, which is an elite school for the Southern African elite. And while I was there, met a lot of people who were involved in the struggle for rights of the African people. And the discussions that I'd hear and the retelling of their histories sort of garnered a huge interest in the plight of South Africans, and especially Black South Africans. But there were also white South Africans who were involved in the struggle and who, were very, had principles. They were principled people. My father found it very hard to teach, and he couldn't understand how people who were given the opportunity to learn didn't take it and, run with it. So he felt frustrated and left teaching, having taught at Waterford and at the technical school in Mbabane. We moved to Botswana, and Botswana had just gone through independence. My interest in the whole colonial experience of Africans grew even more while we were in Botswana. And I sort of immersed myself in Zona culture in a sense, because it had a link to my mother's heritage and culture. It grew as time went on.
Your interactions both with Asarawa communities as well as with Botswana communities. So one of the responses to the Willoughby collection that we heard from colleagues in Botswana was that it's not seen as Tswana heritage or Kalanga heritage. Many people said, this isn't our heritage, this is Basawa or this belongs to the San. I'd be really interested to hear your reflections on that particular response.
One of the things I really value about this project is the opportunity to say to people in Botswana, before we got introduced to top hats, bata shoes, and saddle robe suits, this is what our people wore. The implements that we have, that Willoughby collected, were implements that were used by people before Sheffield Steel was brought in into all the garments that you see. You can find examples from the past, you know, worn by people all the way from the Congo River right down to Table Mountain. And it's part of the issue of decolonizing our thinking to acknowledge where we come from and what was part and parcel of our being, the clothes, the implements and tools that will be collected. And without knowing it, he was preserving a heritage that has got lost in time. Now, Botswana is Sarawak, because if you go into Central District in Botswana, you will still find some people wearing skin clothing and have not wanted to adopt skin clothing wholesale. It feels uncomfortable. It impairs them when they're trying to do the things that they're, you know, they do in order to exist and live. And there's a sense of pride in where they come from, you know, that they still keep a trip to Okavango. You know, the river people will still wear a loincloth as opposed to a whole European outfit, because it's comfortable and it fits in, it works with the environment, it works with the way of life. You go on a hunting trip with the Barwa, the Gung, and everything that they've got makes sense. There's a loincloth with a covering, carrying a quiver with the arrows and a bow slung over the neck. They've got an ostrich egg shell with water, and that's it. You go off on the hunt wearing a safari outfit in that you boil, and it just doesn't make sense. But modern Botswana see that as primitive, and they've been taught to look at it as primitive. But there were reasons why those garments worked and had a function. And today you find designers trying to copy elements of those garments and yet we look down on them. And in, as you say, in the trip to the storage museum stores that RPM have, there were comments like, oh no, this is not China culture, this is, you know, something else, it's Basara, or it's, you know, backward people, backward people's clothing. And it part of our mission to say to people in Botswana, no, this is the clothing that our forebears or your forebears wore. The nice thing about people in South Africa is that they are reaching back into their past and bringing out the clothing that their forebears would have worn before the Europeans came, or as the Europeans came, because beadwork, you know, there's an interaction between the traders, especially Portuguese traders along the West Coast, or the Arab traders who had connections with Venice and the Venetian glassmakers. Part of the collection, you'll see beadwork, and that beadwork has glass beads, which also illustrates an avenue into trade with Arab traders from Mozambique, Tanzania. It imparts a knowledge of where we come from and the things that society went through. And by dismissing it as, you know, Basara clothing, it defeats the whole purpose of decolonizing your brain.
And I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about how that might have influenced your reaction then to seeing colonial collections in the British context. Is the one at Brighton that we've been working with. I mean, how did you feel about a provincial museum like Brighton having a really extensive, important 19th century Botswana collection with a catalogue from 1936 that was still being used up until just now?
Working at Medu set the scene for me in terms of culture, heritage, wanting to explore cultural heritage through art and objects, but it was not formal. It wasn't formalized. And even though I have a very deep desire to understand history and my culture and my heritage, I never looked at myself as somebody who would work in the heritage culture in the full sense of the word. I studied engineering initially, hated it, went back to university, studied politics and economics, and through that got into working with people or for people to help them navigate society. And in the course of doing that work, I started to understand that unless people understood a lot of things about where they come from, their heritage, their culture, they're hollow beings in a sense. And at one point, working with some people who had come over as refugees from South Africa, they were all suffering from stress and had mental problems. And one way of dealing with that was through heritage culture, even just cooking simple African meals or sourcing like boerewors or biltong. It just changed things. And I started thinking about heritage culture and where we're from. And then 84, I think was 80, yeah, 84. I went with Zona students, with Tsegedi Okama's son. He was given the use of the LMS hostel at Sedi Oak. And we spoke, met the priests, and he spoke about, you know, Tsegedi Okama and some of the stuff that they've got in storage there and at the university. And they just said, oh, yeah, you know, some of the stuff should be shared in Botswana, should be in the museum, but it's probably safer here. I didn't think much of it after that. Several years later, ended up in Worthing, trying to work with people from Southern Africa, helping them. I got involved in heritage culture and met Sarah Lee, who then introduced me to Royal Pavilion Museums. And one of the first projects that we worked on was the collecting panel for making for African contemporary collections. And we were doing a bite size one day, and I saw a pot that resonated so strongly with me. It's something that I had seen, interacted with, and loved in my maternal grandmother's house. She had a traditional Bedi homestead, which is made up of three buildings. Two were rondavels or round houses, round huts, and a rectangular living quarter. In the kitchen hut, a round house rondavel, was this pot. And it was a pot that had a certain significance. It's something that I can't put my finger on, but it had a significance, and it had water that you could take a cup. We had this limey green enamel mug that you dip in and pour yourself water with that. And I saw this pot in the Brighton Museum as part of this bite-size exhibition or display. And I said, oh, this is Bedi, to one of the curators. And she says, no, the label says it's from Zambia. It's a Barotse pot. Collected in 1910, I think it was. And I said, well, it might be Barotse, but, you know, Barotse speak Sepedi because they had interacted with the Bakololo. Bakololo were miscreants from the Bedi clans and got together and absconded and ended up in interacting with the Rotsi people of now Congo. And settled in what is now Zambia as the Barotse people. I explained all this to the curator, to Rachel and said, no, this has significance. It's got motifs which are particular to the to my people. It has design elements which are particular to my people. And also it explains the relationship between the Bapedi of South Africa with the Rosfi of the Congo, who have now settled in Zambia. And it's something that we should explore and say a lot more about, because it makes sense to these articles. Then I was invited to have a look at some of the objects that were in storage. And part of that collection was the Willoughby collection. It just brought back my time in Botswana. It just reaffirmed all the things. And in the National Museum, there was a section about the Basarwa people and their clothing, and all of that was there, you know, grain bags, quivers and bow and arrow, the karosses, the tsiha, the shoes, the sandals, rampechan. You know, all those things were there. And it's just, yeah, and I know all these things. I've seen them before, and I've interacted with people wearing them. That was my first introduction to Willoughby collection. I then thought about how are these presented, and, you know, talking about the objects in a way that makes connection to their source and the people that made them. It engendered a need to look into it. You know, we got into a position where I spoke with Nicola, who brought in Neil Parsons, and we had a look at the objects. And then I was asked to be part of the Making Africa Connections project, which is an opportunity to look at the objects, and better still, to take some of the objects back to Soroe. And even though not all of the stuff was collected in Soroe, but they relate to the making of the people of Soroe.
So as part of the Making African Connections trip, you've been working with the museum to develop a partnership with Carmel Memorial Museum. And part of that involved going back to Botswana and doing some interviews around the interpretation and understanding of the objects. It'd be great to hear a bit more from you about how you felt about that and other reflections on that trip.
Yeah, I was really excited when Rachel said, we're planning a trip to Botswana to look at the facilities they've got and to make sure that the loans can happen comfortably. And we also want to do a bit of research around the objects. And she said, you know, your knowledge of Botswana, the ability to speak Setswana would be helpful. So I was really pleased. I was like, yeah, well, okay. I was keen to see the facilities that they had, because when I left Botswana, the Khama Memorial Museum hadn't started, and there was a Norwegian contingent that had been interested to do something around heritage and culture in Botswana. They had set up a museum in Molepolole, but for me it was like a hut and represented a cultural village as opposed to a center of knowledge of heritage and culture. So I was keen and fascinated to find out about the museum. I had once seen the building that houses the main part of the museum, which I'd seen in 1978. Museum started in 84, from around 84 onwards. And to see how a house that Khama the Great, Khama the Third, had built for his business partners had been repurposed and was being used to house memorabilia that related to him, his life, and his family's, you know, his family's descendants' histories was pretty amazing. And then the newly built unit that houses the administration and archives, and later this, I found out, the storage facility for the museum. So yeah, I was quite keen. And then having looked at the stuff that was in storage in Brighton and the promise that some of the objects would be loaned to the museum, I was keen to find out how much of a reach that the museum has into people's psyche, being, how much they touch, you know, into people's value systems. It's difficult to explain, but a museum's, one of the things that they can do is impart a knowledge of one's heritage through physical examples. And if you read about your heritage in a book, it's quite an abstract concept in a way. But if you see something and you know it relates to you, like the Barotse pot, for me, it has a deep resonance that talks to my heritage and culture a lot more than any book and any lesson I had at school about who and what I was. The people that work at the Khama Memorial Museum, for me, had that desire to share knowledge of heritage and culture, but the facilities are not there. And my understanding of working with Medu about how valued the heritage sector in Botswana, or how undervalued it is, was something I wanted to find out about and to understand a bit more about whether it's progressed, regressed, or where it's gone. So as part of that research trip, or the trip, it was enlightening to see that it's actually regressed. It's the views of otherness have been deeply entrenched. Like, the objects are not Tswana anymore. They're now of the other people. There's an otherness to them. They're primitive, and they're not in keeping with the value systems that worthy of the Tswana. And that's one of the things that needed to address. We looked at, as part of the research project and the trip, we looked at the facilities, found short in terms of security, the environment, you know, the controls for the environment, the ultraviolet radiation levels, you know, all the different aspects of conservation were not up to a standard. And the curator, Scobie, had been very reluctant to show us the collection that they had. And as somebody who understands Setswana, I'd hear the conversations with Hase. You know, they'd say, oh, it's embarrassing, we can't show people that's what we've got, because it's embarrassing. We've got a lot of stuff, but we're not looking after it because we can't afford to. And then one day they just called us in and said, look, come and have a look at the stuff we've got in storage. And they've got a treasure trove in there, but a lot of it needs to be fridged up or frozen. The object should be sitting on acid-free paper in enclosed in boxes that, you know, insulate it from the environment. So part of, you know, the research we were doing is just very clear that this museum really needs resources. It needs things, and the objects that they've got in storage could be looked after a lot better, given the right. Having said that, if they were better looked after, they could actually use them as part of displays and exhibitions on a very regular basis and rotate them. But the facilities are not there. The loan from the Khama from the Willoughby collection and a few other bits would have helped in that there's a bit of documentation which relates to the missionary collector and his story and his interaction with Khama, which you can actually stretch and say to people to start to understand that he was collecting from the people that he found there at that point in time. And they must have had a connection with that stuff from before he arrived and before the European hunters had come into Botswana, because it was the hunters and traders who came in before the missionaries and the British officials. It was a way of pushing people to think about where their heritage comes from. And then we also did some research to see if there are any people in the area who can relate to the history of some of the objects. We took pictures with us to show and to try and talk about the objects and talk about the sources and the people that would have made those things. A few interviews, one with an old man who's actually from South Africa, Pedi, but had been there since he was a young boy. And he had seen Botswana go from the Second World War through to current day Botswana. And he spoke at length about the community where he lived, Chadibeng. And he explained about some of the elements of culture that he'd experienced, seen, and is a valuable source of information. We also spoke to somebody who works with skins, leather worker, who is making goatskin rugs, which are traditional Tswana wedding rugs that you'd have at a wedding or reception. And also they tend to be ground blankets if once they've been used for the primary purpose. And some people have them as ornaments on their walls. The more intricately made ones are put up, which is quite nice. We also interviewed a wood carver who explained some of the processes of carving, uses of the objects that he makes, like the pestle and mortar, big spoons for stirring porridge, especially at weddings, and then small utensils, which are not traditional Tswana objects, but when the missionaries brought along teaspoons and forks and knives and spoons, you know, they were copied in wood. And he showed us some of those, and then some carvings of animals where he took his images from a torn up guidebook, guide magazine, in fact, which is really quite sweet in a way. So yeah, we went through with him all the process. And then a basket maker who explained about basket making, sources of materials that she uses, tools, designs. And that was interesting because basket making in Botswana has become an industry. And I have friends who run Botswana Craft, and the major sales are baskets made by women in the Okavango. The trip in itself opened up my eyes to the way that we could make Willoughby's collection come back to life in a way that would be of benefit to the people of Botswana. And if it hadn't been for COVID, I think some of that process could have happened in the correct way. what I would have loved to see is to relate to the objects in a way that will force people in Botswana to think about where they come from as a people and to look at themselves in a pre-colonial context and bring it in and see, you know, what value systems they have that they've put aside, and it's made them lesser for it, if that makes sense. Yeah, and also the makeup of the Botswana people is something that is contested and I think needs discussion and debate.
So you've talked a little bit about the value of these kinds of collections going back to Botswana in the future. And obviously there's been a big push from the Macron report, the debates about repatriation of African cultural heritage. So it would be really interesting to have your thoughts on what is the role of a collection such as this? Does it have a role in terms of decolonizing British institutions? Should it be on display in Brighton here? Can we use it here? What is its future? Should it be sent back to Botswana? What might be the time frame for that? I'd be really interested to hear your reflections on the Willoughby collection.
Yeah, the whole debate around repatriation is framed as one issue, but different collections, the way they were collected, they're contested narratives regarding the collection and the way that they were collected. Benin bronzes were looted. Stuff from the Sudan was consequence of war. Other stuff was taken, stolen without the consent of the owners. Now the Willoughby collection does not fit into that framework. He went out there and, like he would as a tourist, he acquired items. He was learning about Zona culture, and in the process of learning, he would buy objects that related to that lesson that he was given by Ramaswamy. There isn't an issue in terms of ownership there. It brings me to the point of the debate around repatriation. Now, the loan in itself would be a fantastic thing in that it would kickstart a debate in Botswana about Zona heritage and culture. It would also start to address the issue of a group of people that came into the country and changed the social structures that they found and came across. And this is a snapshot of what they found or what was there at that particular point in time. If you collected the stuff in 1879, this is what Botswana was like in 1879. Willoughby is also important that he was taking photographs of people and the environment. So part of the collection and the archives relates to the way people lived in Botswana at that point. Apart from kickstarting debate, knowledge, I think the collection is better kept in Britain in order to be used to educate the British public as to the efforts that were made by the people that came from Britain, the missionaries and settlers and officials, and to show how the interactions between people, that if they went along with labeling and text that was in context, that explained the objects in themselves and explained the relationship that those objects have with the people of Botswana, it would serve a better purpose for Botswana today than it would if the stuff was taken back to Botswana and kept in Botswana for the consumption of 2.2 million people only. Whereas here, you're dealing with the people that basically were the oppressors of that society and social structure, and those who can make a difference in the way that relationships are happening. And for me, as a as an activist and an advocate for the diaspora, it would be a valuable tool to teach us and our children the value systems that we come from in the context of the British society, in a British institution. So yeah, I a lot of people might think that it's not correct, but I think this, the objects are better off in Britain, in British institutions, unless there's a contested history or they have a sacred, a link to the sacred for societies. Stuff was taken from Kenya that had a spiritual link. There are one or two objects in the Willoughby collection that would normally not be available for sale because they have a special spiritual significance to a family or a people, like the eyes of the elephant and a couple of charms that are in the collection. But apart from that, I would say no, the stuff should stay here. And that a lot of stuff that is here, there are examples in Botswana today that can be sourced and be used in displays. Enough. And the other thing is there's a lot of, there's a sense in Britain that this stuff doesn't relate to British culture. Now, the first thing is, if anybody reads Neil Parsons' book, Joe, the Great Emperor, you get a sense that what he's actually talking about is Victorian Britain, Dickensian Britain, contrasting it with Willoughby's Africa. It's for us to share that message that you had a society in Britain that was struggling a lot more than people in Botswana, in Dickensian terms. And that the objects can actually be part and parcel of that narrative here in Britain. Also, I was giving a bite-sized talk in place of Helen Mears at Brighton Museum, and a lady came in. I had a few objects from the Willoughby collection, a straw hat, a skin cross, and a few things. And she sort of looked at it. There's a picture of Willoughby next to the church, and then the three horsey. And she said, what has the stuff got to do with Brighton? You know, this museum is for the people of Brighton. We should have things that relate to us and not, you know, from Africa. What? And I said, sorry, lady, but the person who collected the stuff went to Africa and collected it. He came back and he was the priest in that church just behind this building. And he spent a lot of his time here preaching about the things that he'd learnt in Africa. And he collected the stuff as part and parcel of that process of being a priest. And she went off in a huff. I just thought, okay, we've got a long way to go in educating people in Brighton about our history, or Brighton's history, actually.
Oh, thank you. It's interesting to hear that you feel that there is a role for a collection like that in a place like Brighton, and that it can be told to tell a story that can be useful to you and to others in anti-racist work and into better understanding of colonial history.